You're listening to Live Free, Think Free on 90.1 KPFT Houston, your home for uncensored news and underground music since 2011.
All right, another episode of Live Free, Think Free. I'm Micah. I'm here with a good friend and co-host from the beginning, Derek. We've been working on this show for over 11 years, I believe. Always sharing the best music and art that we can find. That little intro piece is a piece of Jeremy Carswell, Dance All Night. That's from his 2025 album. We love featuring musicians as well as other artists. We've had comedians on here, and we were just talking about comedians. So if you know people in the Houston area particularly, or if you know conscious artists, you know, that are speaking to something, you know, reach out to us. Send us a link. You know, tell us about send us the Spotify, tell us about them. We're always getting suggestions and we're always discovering our own. So we know we have, you know, pretty intelligent audience as far as, you know, what they consume in pop culture, for lack of a better word. And, if you know of music that you think fits this show, send us that. And I know we got a interesting show coming at you. And,
yeah, absolutely.
2023.
Yeah, first show of the new year. Everybody, just want to remind you, as Micah was saying, you can find us at thehoustonfreethinkers.com. Just in case you're interested in seeing who we are. Johnny's not with us tonight, but he was here last night, and he'll be back soon. If you want to catch any of our previous episodes, we're pretty good at posting the archives, including the links for every episode. So, for example, you go to thehoustonfreethinkers.com, click on last week's episode. 2023 will be a crucial year for liberty, and you can see links to all the different stories that we referenced. There's an audio version if you want to just listen instead of watch. All that can be found at thehoustonfreethinkers.com, and we're on Spotify. We are on all the platforms wherever you listen to music, podcasts, etc. Search Live Free, Think Free, and you'll want to look for this picture of me, Micah, and Johnny, and you'll find us there. So, yeah, definitely excited for tonight. Got a couple of things to start with before we get into some Houston news. First thing I want to just mention, you know, sometimes at the beginning of the show we talk about events happening, and I mentioned at the end of last week's show with Johnny that I have an event coming up that I'm co-producing along with John Bush called The Greater Reset. People can find it at thegreaterreset.org. Our next event is The Greater Reset 4 co-creation, happening January 18th to the 22nd. It's happening live in Morelia, Mexico, where I live, and in Central Texas, specifically Bastrop, for those who know Texas, and streaming for free online at our website. So you don't have to register. You don't have to pay anything. You can sit at home and watch it if you choose. We're also telling people to organize local watch parties, or what we call activation hubs. If you scroll down to the website, you see this map of people who are hosting watch parties in different parts of the U.S. and other areas. So if you want to do that, organize in your community, 5 days, five themes: liberate your mind, body, and soul, permaculture and food independence, parallel networks, taking back our tech, building free and conscious communities, 40 plus speakers. We have live musicians for the in-person audiences, just a whole lot going on, workshops in person. I mean, if you can come in person, I was saying something about this the other day, Micah, in a video I did, and I'm sure you have some thoughts on this, that I realized that there are people in the loosely, broadly named truth, freedom community, liberty community, who have only experienced it through the internet. Like, they've never been to an in-person event, whether that's a small activist event or a big thing like the Greater Reset, or, you know, some sort of Liberty Festival, or they got events like Jackalope, you know, Camp Out, or Pork Fest in New Hampshire. Not necessarily just explicitly libertarian or voluntarist events, but just getting out there and connecting with people, whether it's a protest, a rally, a march, a festival, a conference. But I realize that, yeah, a lot of people don't do that. They haven't yet. And so their experience of the community is only online.
Why do you think that might be? And or two questions, pick one. Why do you think that is? And or talk to me about your first experience of going to something like that, and how it was different than all your online interactions.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll answer both just briefly. Why? I mean, I think some people maybe are, well, on a basic level, maybe they think they're too busy, which I get. I mean, when we were doing activism full time together, and I mean full time, like it was like about a decade ago when we were starting to work together, a little bit more than that. And that was like a daily, let's get online and post articles and share information. Okay, let's go out to the Federal Reserve and hold signs of protest, or let's work on organizing the next event, or host a music show with bands and artists, and, you know, do activism that way. You know, it's a lot. So maybe there are people who don't have time to organize or even attend events like that, or they feel that way. Maybe I've talked to some people who like people who through the Freedom Cell Network have been able to meet other people who have said some of it's just they're intimidated, they're insecure, they're not really used to being. Some people, you know, are living lives, especially I've noticed recently younger men, like through the internet, and so they're sometimes socially awkward or maybe don't know how to talk to other people or are just afraid. A lot of different reasons I think hold people back. But as far as like what for me, we started doing things locally in Houston together. I started just as I was doing my journey, just going to different groups and, okay, I'll go to this protest, I'll go to this meeting. I just wanted to meet people. But then once I started to go to events, either in Houston or then it was like Austin, and then eventually started going to events for like 9/11 in New York, that was a really awesome experience. It just spurred me on further because I met activists from other cities who seemed to be just as motivated and passionate as me. And it was like, oh, cool, you're doing what I'm doing just from some other place. And I didn't even know that that existed before. It just wasn't even in my horizon that there were other activists, other people, citizen journalists, whatever, you know, trying to spread information and do good in the world and that were trying to do it full time and like really passionately. So it kind of gave me, I guess, go ahead that like, okay, this is possible. There is some sort of path here. Just keep going. And every time I've gone in person, I've always enjoyed it. I mean, there's some events that are better than others, but generally speaking, I meet some awesome people, or maybe you make a new networking connection or business connection or a partnership of some kind, or maybe you just have a good time recognizing that you're not alone. I think that's a key thing, right? So many people used to come to the Houston Freethinkers meetings. We've seen this for, you know, 7-8 years. I thought I was alone. I didn't even know you existed. I didn't know there was anybody who felt this way. It's the same thing at events like the Greater Reset or any other event you might go to. If it's your first time, you might have that kind of experience of just that kind of profound and great feeling of realizing you're not the only one who feels a certain way or thinks a certain way. And I think that alone is really empowering.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's empowering because I think that most of us believe we're in the minority with these ideas. And we see these ideas as so important. Let's just say, you know, this group of ideas that the bulk of the people around us that talk about these things may agree on. I know there's still going to be a lot of difference, but to run into a group of people that shares these ideas, even if you don't continue to go to that, it's a really unique experience. I remember some of the first things I went to that were kind of like rallies, and at them were diverse other people getting the word out, like, right? I was there to basically hear a speaker, and amongst the crowd, people were moving, you know, pamphlets, little printed out things, and like in such a way that it made it really interesting. And I, you know, discovered a lot of different things to research for a while, you know, through the leads that I got there, as you were saying, the connects, you know, and I remember just the feeling of that, like, wow, all, you know, all this information is coming out. And it was at a time, you know, I think people were seeing past the Bush, the Clintons, and, you know, we were getting up around that first round of bailouts. The Federal Reserve was becoming a hot topic. I don't know. I think that it was just really interesting to see so much energy. And I don't know that I would want to always be in that, but I would definitely recommend, you know, going to something. Go to something and connect on some issue that you care about. Go see that there's other people that care about it. And then see, you know, maybe there'll be tertiary groups like what I was talking about in the crowd, you know, giving you little bits of information. And then you're like, wait, I also wondered about that and that. So I don't know. I've always had a lot of fun with that.
Absolutely. I encourage you to do it. So, yeah, and I think it's just important to think about it because it's something that has dawned on me and realizing that there are a lot of people who only experience the movement through the internet. And again, just going to mention the GreaterReset.org. This event's coming up January 18th to the 22nd. There's still time to come in person if you want to come to Texas and Mexico. Still plenty of space there. And if we can, real quick, I'm going to play this. It's about a minute and 30, minute 40 seconds, this trailer for the Greater Reset Force, so you guys get an idea of it, and we'll be right back and get into these stories.
Are you sick of being told you will own nothing and be happy?
Are you sick of being told how to live your life by the mainstream media?
Exactly what people think, and this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Are you exhausted with the truth community, focusing only on the problems?
Are you ready to do something about it?
Let's take action together. Join the Freedom Cell Network in January 2023 as we return with the Greater Reset for co-creation.
The Greater Reset is a five-day in-person and online gathering where solutions-focused speakers and organizations share practical steps for individual and collective liberation.
This year, we'll even hear experiences from real communities on the ground across multiple continents.
The Greater Reset 4 will focus on activating five focus areas over 5 days.
January 18th, liberate your mind, body, and soul.
January 19th, permaculture and food independence.
January 20th, agorism and parallel networks.
January 21st, take back our tech.
January 22nd, building free and conscious communities.
This is our time to co-create the world we want for 2030 and beyond.
Join us as we lay the foundation for the next stage of a free humanity.
Join us from January 18th to the 22nd, 2023, as we gather online, in person in Central Texas and Morelia, Mexico.
Join us for the Greater Reset 4, co-creation.
View the full speakers list and organize your local activation hub at thegreaterreset.org.
All right. Again, find that at thegreaterreset.org. Thank you to the Philip who made that really cool. And let's go for it. I do recommend, I know we had a comment a moment ago just asking the question, do you go to in-person freedom events or only participate online? We got the Eerie Fairy over on YouTube saying, I have gone to a few in person, but could probably do more. So yeah, anybody else who wants to comment, we'll share your thoughts and comments as we go through the show. Mike, I actually just had one other thing I wanted to mention, because it's our first show of the new year, and I know that there's a lot of our culture and the U.S. or the North America, maybe it's everywhere now, this idea of the new year, of course, being a new time, a new set of 12 months to do better than you have before. And there's this idea of New Year's resolutions. And I find it funny because at least in the U.S., there's this sort of culture of making New Year's resolutions, but already anticipating breaking them, right? You know, it's kind of just like a joke of like, oh, yeah, you're going to do them and they're going to last about a week and then you're going to break them and you'll go back to whatever. And then there's different things. Like, for example, I noticed that come the new year, all the gyms have specials because they know that there's people who are like, oh, it's time to get myself in shape and, you know, start off doing good, right? So I just wanted to look into that. I started looking up the etymology of the word resolution, and I just wanted to share a little bit about that and, you know, have your thoughts too as well, Micah. But I think it's interesting. So just this one section says resolution is from the Latin solvere, to loosen, release, and explain, which I thought was interesting. But then you go a little deeper, it says the term New Year's resolution from the 1780s drew from the determined sense of the word resolute. And that was kind of what I was thinking of, is like, okay, the root word of resolute or resolve. And so right here it goes on, it says, in the 1540s, the word came to suggest the solving of a problem. The sense of resolute, meaning firm or determined, arose simultaneously, the notion being that one who is resolute has solved any dilemma and come to a firm decision. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And then again, eventually there's around 1780, it says, like, you get to the idea of these New Year's resolutions. So the idea is, or the root of this word resolution could be resolute, you know, being firm in your decision. And then also that other word of resolve, or resolver, I guess is the original, however you pronounce that in Latin. But they put right here as well, resolution is still in use today, mostly via the notion of, goes otherwise less common than other meetings and most often the form resolve. So resolve is another way to think about this. They talk about it in terms of resolution, like scientific meaning. But I think that that word of resolve, like to resolve to do something, to be resolute about something, to be firm, committed, I think that's really what it's all about, right? So maybe people have gotten, or the culture has gotten to the way where resolutions, whether you find them important or not, you know, it's just another day maybe, right? Maybe it doesn't matter if it's a new set of months that we have named and put out there. But at the very least, it could be an opportunity to think about and maybe consider the way you're approaching your life, and you make these resolutions, you resolve to do something, to be resolute about something, to be firm in that decision. I don't know. Maybe that's a better way to think about it. I just wanted to throw that out there because I was looking up the word earlier today.
I'd like to mention some stuff on that, some thoughts quickly. Resolve, you know, that's got a quick also definition. One of it is, you know, to basically to solve a problem. So You know, think about this. And if you really want to use these, the power that might be in resolutions, right, and making a firm stand and, you know, being able to do that, that maybe it should be some particular problem that you've solved, that you've come to see in a new light, that you've resolved, that this is the problem, like this is the stumbling block, this is what it may be. You know, I think that might be a little bit more profound when you can, rather than like, oh, I'm just gonna, you know, I'm gonna eat better, lose weight, quit smoking, you know, like that type of stuff. But like, maybe if I came to understand directly why I was, you know, perhaps drinking an extra soda a day, you know, what was the motivation, what was the triggers in me, and I, you know, kind of like from that sort of perspective, resolve to do something about it, you know, that I could solve a problem on my own like that and combine this power of a resolution with the clear vision of what I need to do, rather than just this wishful thinking of, oh yeah, new year.
Exactly. Exactly. It's kind of just like a sort of Hallmark version of what it could be, right? It's just like, okay, New Year's resolution. And it's funny too, because this is just another thing. We can move on after this. I'm done at least. This, and again, in the culture, I'm just speaking from what I know of the North America, Mexico, and the U.S., very similar in this way. But the New Year is a time of party, right? So you kind of party it up on the New Year, and then you wake up maybe feeling like crap, but you're supposed to be starting off fresh, right? Like, I always thought that was interesting, right? Because maybe you're like, all right, New Year, I want to go to the gym a couple times a week. I'm going to do this. I'm going to eat healthy and all those usual things like you're saying, quit smoking. But to kick things off, you have a really wild party and, you know, go all nuts and then recover from that. At least that's how some of us have done it. I've been there before. And yeah, whatever you're doing, whatever your resolutions are, if you make them, maybe rethink it in the terms of what we've talked about here, to resolve to do something, to be resolute about it. But all right, let's go in. I know we got a couple of stories in Houston and Texas. I'll pull these up. Michael, let's dive in.
Yeah, let's get into it. You know, there's so many diverse things we talk about. Sometimes I feel like the news is trite compared to the other things. So it turns out that this might be interesting to some people that don't, you know, particularly get involved in politics. Down in Galveston, they've elected a treasurer who's decided not to take the $117, almost an eighth of $1 million a year salary. That's right. The new Galveston County treasurer won't take the $117,000 salary after saying he wants to do away with the office. Now, we've heard about this before, have we not, Derek? And here we go. Let's get into it. Hank Duggie, who campaigned and won a spot as Galveston County's newest treasurer on a platform calling to eliminate the office, said he won't take the salary the position has historically drawn. This former League City Council member signed an affidavit confirming plans to not draw a salary while in office and continuing his efforts to end the position in Galveston County. He said, quote, I think electing to forego a salary could help build a level of trust with taxpayers and citizens of Galveston County. When you're trying to do something kind of unique like this, having the trust of the voters is important. And that proves so, because they're going to have to vote on it. Duggie, I'm not sure how you say the man's last name, took over as the Galveston County's newest treasurer this year, January 1st. He campaigned and won the spot. Taking it from an incumbent, actually, arguing voters should do away with the office and other county offices should take over its duties. Galveston County already employs a chief financial officer and internal and outside auditors who can handle many of the office's duties, he argues. Accomplishing that task would take both a action from the Texas legislature and voter approval. Duggie says that he already made several visits to Austin and is confident that some legislators would move a measure giving Galveston County their voters there the chance to decide whether or not they need this office. And he was confident voters could decide as soon as November whether or not to abolish the office. And if it was approved, the office would be eliminated starting January 1st. And I guess they'd save like $500,000 every 4 years just on that one person's salary. They have six people who work in that office and an annual budget, I think, of $600,000. So, you know, it's an interesting turn. I think we should watch what happens.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how that plays out. It's giving me some ideas.
Yeah, no doubt. There's probably a lot of excess. And, you know, trimming the fat, especially at the, you know, we've talked about the economic problems forever. They haven't gotten any better. So, you know, and they haven't stayed the same. So, you know, maybe it's time to start doing this, like, in our own lives and at the governmental level. I mean, this, if it's waste, it's waste. But I guess it's cool to give more and more things back to the voters to decide. You know, I just kind of thought about that a little bit too, you know, to vote on some of these things that have just been entrenched for, you know, generations now. How long has Galveston County had a treasurer? Probably since it's been a county, you know. But yeah, that one was interesting, I thought.
Interesting stuff. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's always a good time to, I mean, it's always interesting for somebody who takes a government position to start talking about how they can cut it, or I'm not going to take the salary. And I think people made a big deal when Trump did that because he had his own money. But this is somebody who's actually doing that, but then trying to actually abolish the position they're holding. So that's cool.
Yeah, and we haven't heard about this guy, you know, like we had Trump. You know what I mean? Like, everybody kind of assumed Trump was this rich, not rich guy type thing, you know, some sort of hybrid that had access to money. So it wasn't a big surprise for him to, in my opinion, to pass up, you know, presidential pay. It isn't all that much. I mean, the speaking tours probably pay you more. But yeah, yeah, exactly. This guy kind of more, you know, I'm not trying to say he doesn't make money, whoever this guy is, but he probably isn't at that level.
Which one you want to jump into now? We got this man arrested, or
yeah, let's go straight into that. You know, for a while now we've been covering, you know, various events that occur in our jail here because it's a pretty severe jail. Turns out as of January 4th, there was the main point of this article was about Jacob Pillowey. He was arrested Sunday afternoon for trespassing, a misdemeanor offense, and brought to Harris County Jail, where he was ordered to be interviewed for a mental health evaluation, according to the court records. The sheriff's office says that he was set to be released on a $100 PR bond Tuesday morning, but the process was interrupted when Pillow allegedly assaulted a detention officer. You know, I think that's strange, and the fact that he was getting mental evaluation is strange. Who knows what, how much more they'll develop the documents and have things to, you know, speak to that. But I don't think your average person who's about to get out on a $100 PR bond and go home is going to typically assault a detention officer. So either he's not just a normal person trying to get out of jail, or this is peculiar. Anyway, it turns out that it resulted in him being hit with an additional charge. Another reason never to go to jail. You can always get in worse trouble there, according to the sheriff's office. According to the sheriff's office, jail staff used force to restrain Pillow, and brought back to his cell after being evaluated by medical personnel. So, I mean, I guess he must have got scratched or, you know, tased or something, and, you know, because he had to be looked at by medical personnel after the use of force. The next morning, he was found unresponsive in his cell and was taken to a hospital where he was pronounced dead at 9:12 a.m. The sheriff's office says the police department is leading a criminal investigation into the incident, an internal investigation is being conducted by the sheriff's office to determine whether all departmental policies and procedures were followed. Pillow's death comes, and we were speaking about this probably two episodes ago, after at least 27 people have died in custody this year. This is the highest number in nearly two decades. As of July 4th, there were 9,940 people in jail. Critics say the ever-growing population has been exacerbated by Senate Bill 6, which bans cashless bail for those charged with a felony and mandates the creation of a public safety report for every person brought into jail. The law keeps low-income defendants behind bars and worsens delays by adding additional steps to an already clogged bureaucratic criminal justice system. So,
yeah, and you know, we talked about just on that one point, I'll just say, because I mean, anybody who's been in the county of Harris County, Houston area at any point can understand how horrible these places are, even with them trying to improve the intake center and things like that over recent years. It's a violent place. It can be. The cops definitely can get violent in some cases and feel like they can get away with things. But this conversation about the spike of the growth in the county and the concerns around, like what you were just mentioning, that like penalizing poor people with the bail system. We've talked about that. There is a real conversation to be had. And at the same time, we have places like Houston and other places where their approach with dealing with that is letting people off who maybe somebody gets arrested and they actually were arrested for a violent crime and they let them off in this, you know, new kind of attempt to fix this, the criminal justice system or to fix the bail bond system. And then those people go out and commit crimes. I mean, there's definitely plenty of stories like that happening. Not to say that happens with every single person, right? But it seems like some people are maybe, as usual, taking things to the extreme. And so you have an attempt to say, hey, we don't need to lock people up just because they can't afford to pay this bail and they're a nonviolent person, they're in there on a ticket or whatever. And that should be a situation, right, that we should consider and think about. But then maybe that shouldn't apply to people who are in there for their third violent assault or something like that, right? So it's just, yeah, I think there's a lot going on with this conversation.
Yeah, for sure. We've watched it develop over years now. And, you know, the one thing it was saying there was in felony cases, and I imagine there's some nonviolent felony cases, some state felony cases, that sort of thing. But yeah, you know, there's a lot to be discussed here. And there are too many people, you know, in there. There's too many people dying. Our county is, you know, a bit crazy out there. I mean, sometimes, you know, hunting for the news that we'll talk about, you got to go through a lot of just, you know, small crime type stuff. But yeah, I guess we should move on to this other one, or should we take a music break? I mean, getting up there.
Let's hit this last local one, and then we'll go to the break so we can come back and go a little wider. Tonight, we're going to be talking after the music break. I have a pretty, I think, big story about fluoride this case I've been following that we've talked about. And in a different world, it might be front page on some newspaper. Mike has got some stories about IRS. I got another court ruling related to COVID mandates. We've been covering those over the recent months because some are going in the favor of the people, like businesses not being able to force their employees. And then in the case of the one I'm going to cover today, it's not going in the favor of bodily autonomy and choice and things like that. So lots more to cover once we get back to the music. But yeah, let's hit this last one, Micah.
Yeah, this one's pretty quick, but it's nothing new in some ways, but it is new news in a whole other way. Precinct 3 Commissioner Tom Ramsey on Thursday announced that he will be providing license plate reading technology to law enforcement in Harris County in order to help them improve their efforts in identifying criminal activity. The readers, which cost $2,500 a year per camera to operate, will send real-time alerts to law enforcement. And this is what I think is kind of curious. When a vehicle associated with crime is captured on camera, we've witnessed the success of this technology in Spring Valley, Baytown, and other jurisdictions. So we worked with our constables to find the best locations in unincorporated areas of Precinct 3 to install them, said Ramsey. This helps law enforcement catch wanted vehicles quickly. It acts as another set of eyes for law enforcement. So if you're looking to break the law in Precinct 3, move elsewhere because this isn't the place. Now, I just want to talk about the article from a couple of perspectives real quick. The article itself, you know, this part where they say it will send real-time alerts to law enforcement when a vehicle associated with crime is captured on camera. Okay, I mean, it makes it, by leading that early in the article, it makes it sound like it's only kind of more focused on a vehicle in a crime. And the other part down there, it's going to be installed somewhere, reading the plates, going by every day. And, you know, it's back to that old thing, you know, to how monitored do you want to be to feel safe? How monitored? Can I put a camera right up in your dome?
Yeah, I think that's, and this is, I'm showing on screen right here an article that I wrote way back in 2015, and I'm sure we covered on this show. American Civil Liberties Union back then in 2015 filing open records request and finding that the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration had given hundreds of thousands of dollars to local and state law enforcement for the purchase of these, what are known as ALPRs, automatic license plate readers. So, you know, this has been an issue for some time now. And I'm pretty sure the Houston Police Department already, this one's about Harris County, right? This specific one, right? Precinct 3. Yeah, so I think there's other law enforcement in Houston that already have them, and most people aren't even paying attention to them. And you do notice them, like, for example, when you go to a toll booth anywhere in the city, especially the ones that are automated where you don't have to stop, or like if you cross the border and there's all those crazy cameras that they flash, that's the automatic license plate readers. It's like taking pictures of the license plates as it's going. And the one thing that I wrote about years ago is that there is real danger of these, let's see if I can find it, of these here's another one, 2015, FBI invested in license plate readers despite tech privacy concerns. But there is evidence that some cops had used these lists, like you were just asking about this line about them saying cars suspected of crime, things like that. Or well, they show that the cops can create what they call hot lists. So say there is a certain criminal that they might be keeping an eye on in a certain town. Like that's the best case scenario. They have this car on a tag list, which it's sort of questionable whether that's even legal, right? Because a person maybe hasn't committed a crime, but maybe they're a suspect or they're following them. And so they put their car on a hot list and it pings them like, oh, your car is in the area or things like that. And there was already examples of at least one cop back then in the mid-2010s using it to track his wife, like to spy on his wife, using his, he created a hot list basically that included his wife and some other people that he was monitoring, not outside of his job, right? So obviously there's a clear potential for abusing this technology.
Yeah. I don't know. I do think it's something important to talk about. I don't think that there's, you know, much that can be done in some ways. I mean, it's like stopping the red light cameras, you know, and then, you know, it's just like, it's so insidious, all this monitoring stuff, that there's only so much that I think you can do. Maybe that's a bit of a cynical view. I don't know. Maybe someone out there will correct me. But at the same time, I think it's interesting to see how they employ these new things, the rhetoric that comes out around them. And yeah, they've been around before. I remember us covering them a while back. I think it was an article you brought, and one of the locales was mentioned in that article, was mentioned by this Tom Ramsey or whoever, of Spring Valley here, and a couple of the other small communities like that. So I don't know if they sometimes bring them in into metroplexes, into smaller communities, because it's easier to shape that board into doing something, and then it's already like in the metroplex. It's just at this little, you know.
That makes sense. So, yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and go to our music break. We're going to hear a song from Jeremy Carswell. But Micah, you sent me this. It seems like Jeremy's got a new release coming up.
We are going to hear a song from Jeremy Carswell. And maybe we'll hear this song in the future. This song drops January 17th, and it's pretty exciting. I was out there at Sugar Hill, and if y'all don't know about Sugar Hill Recording Studios, it is one of the oldest. It is the second oldest continuously operating recording studio, and it's right here in Houston. So I thought that was pretty cool. And we worked with some friends. You may remember Angel, Derek, but. Yeah, so he's dropping that. He's been a longtime supporter of the show. He's come on the show. He's played benefits. And I just wanted to, you know, shout out that that's dropping January 17th. And, you know, you can follow him on Spotify and check out the other albums that are out there. He's got an album dropping in February, and he's got this single dropping January 17th. So, yeah, let's hear some music.
Let's hear Distant Dream for now. We'll be right back. You're listening to Live Free, Think Free. Welcome back. Welcome back to Live Free, Think Free. We do this every week for the last 11, going on 12 years. You can find us at thehoustonfreethinkers.com. You can find us all over streaming platforms if you look up Live Free, Think Free. And we got you for another 20 minutes or so, so we're going to dive into some more stories. We'd love to hear your comments because we're live right now on Facebook, on several places, YouTube, Rockfin, and Odyssey. And later on, this will get uploaded to BitChute and other places. So thank you.
You might be in an archive of this on KPFT.
Yeah, hopefully soon you'll be hearing our archives on KPFT as well. We're still working with KPFT Associated. They're building some of the new studios and things are going on there. So we hope to be back soon. Well, Mike, I got a story here that I think is pretty important, and it's an ongoing one of what we've been following for going over 2 years now when this fluoride trial first started, and I started covering it in the summer of 2020. And I think I covered it back in October when there was a recent hearing. Basically, long story short, for those who are not familiar with this case at all, the Fluoride Action Network, Food and Water Watch, and a few other groups sued the EPA back in 2016 originally, claiming that water fluoridation violated the Toxic Substance Abuse Act. And there was a bunch of back and forth for a couple of years until 2020 when it finally made it to a hearing and you know, a lawsuit trial and all this stuff with the judge reviewing the data. And I covered that extensively. At the end of that, those hearings, though, in going into the fall of 2020, the judge said, hey, you know what? There's some new studies that are supposed to be coming out from the U.S. National Toxicology Program. Why don't we wait before we make a decision? I don't want to rule yet, so let's wait for the National Toxicology Program to release what's called a monograph, a review of all the available data on fluoride's toxicity. Well, 2 years passed, and nothing came out, and it was supposed to come out in May 2022. Nothing happened. Well, October 2022, at the most recent hearing, the Fluoride Action Network attorneys were trying to convince the judge to say, hey, look, we have no idea if they're ever going to release this. We've been waiting for almost 3 years now. Can we just go ahead, judge, and resubmit some new information? Basically trying to get them to the point of like, we need you to make a ruling. And so that could be like, we're going to start the whole trial over again and present new evidence, or just get him to go based on what he's seen. And he said that, well, look, I want a copy of this NTP study. I want to know, he was asking the government attorney, why has this not come out? You know, what's going on? They're arguing against releasing it. They're saying you shouldn't make a ruling. You shouldn't rule on the pre-publication, the draft version, and the draft version said that fluoride was toxic and caused IQ loss. They said you shouldn't rule on that draft version. You should wait for the final version. The judge wasn't really buying it because he was saying, look, this could take years. So at the end of the October hearings, he told the Fluoride Action Network attorneys, if you can get a copy through FOIA request or discovery of the NTP study, you can present it to me, but it has to be in redacted form because he doesn't want us, the public, to see it, but the judge can see it. And then I'll make another ruling in January. So that upcoming hearing is January 12th, next Thursday. We'll be reporting on that, whatever the latest update is. So I decided to go to the Fluoride Action Network. That's like everything that's happened, right? Up until this point, October, and then all the way to January. But I decided to go check out the Fluoride Action Network website just a couple days ago to see if there was any updates. And I noticed that in December, right before Christmas, Michael Connett, the attorney for the Fluoride Action Network, had filed four different exhibits to the judge, including he was able to obtain the National Toxicology Program monograph of fluoride toxicity. It's all redacted. If you look at the, you know, pull up the documents, it's all totally redacted so people like us can't see what exactly is said. But he did get it, and he was able to present it to the judge. And here you can see, for those on screen, this is the NTP's May 2022 monograph. It's only about 2.5 pages long. And I'm guessing it's not in favor of fluoride, because you would imagine if it was, the government would be in a rush to get it out and scream it from the rooftops. But instead, even in court, it's being redacted and we can't see it. So that alone is frustrating and interesting. But the main point I want to make today with this story and what I wrote this article about is that the attorney, Michael Connett, also included four exhibits, which include emails between the National Toxicology Program and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. He got these by filing open records requests. I'm assuming he said, hey, give me all communications between the NTP and the CDC relating to fluoride and this monograph. And so of whatever they got, they submitted four different exhibits to the judge to review. And these emails are pretty damning, Micah. And this is what I was saying, like in a different world, maybe this story might be front page news, because I'll just say it right from the beginning here, that these emails show that the Assistant Secretary for Health, who is Rachel Levine, formerly known as Richard Levine, who's the transgender assistant secretary for health, that has been controversial for different reasons, most recently calling for censoring of health information and just things like that. Well, the emails show that the assistant secretary for health directly intervened in the NTP releasing this study, this monograph that was supposed to be coming out in May 2022. So one email dated June 3rd, 2022 shows Nicole Johnson, who is an associate director for policy, partnerships, and strategic communication at the CDC's oral health division. And she was contacting Jennifer Greaser, a senior public health policy analyst in CDC's Washington office. So you got someone in CDC's oral health division emailing somebody in public health policy analysis in Washington CDC's office. And she states, Nicole Johnson states, the latest we heard yesterday is that ASH Levine has put the report on hold until further notice. And again, that refers to the U.S. Assistant Secretary of Health, Rachel Levine, I'm not sure. Then, as I mentioned, the emails were released as part of this lawsuit. So it goes further, though. I started using the hashtag fluoride emails or fluoride files, since everybody's talking about the Twitter files. But the emails go on, and it makes it clear, as Michael Connett, the attorney, said to the judge in these documents, quote, these emails confirm that the NTP considered the May 2022 monograph to be the NTP's final report. They also confirmed that the CDC was opposed to the NTP releasing the report and that leadership at the top levels of the Department of Health and Human Services intervened to stop the report from being released. And as he said, on April 28, 2022, Dr. Mary Wolf, who's from the NTP's Office of Policy Review and Outreach, emailed somebody else named Casey Hannon, the director of the CDC's Division of Oral Health, April 28, 2022, letting them know that their analysis conclusions are set. And they also, the Dr. Wolf also from the NTP also told the CDC that they had reviewed the CDC's submitted comments. I'm guessing the CDC looked at their draft and said, hey, we should think you should do this and this. And they said, thank you, but no thanks. And they made it clear. The email says, we plan to release this in mid to late May. This is 2022. Then fast forward about a week and a half later, May 11, 2022, Dr. Wolf again tells Hannon over at the CDC that the NTP has, quote, set May 18, 2022 for publication of the monograph. The monograph will be posted to the NTP website, and we will email a notice of the posting to the NTP listserv subscribers. However, later that day and the next day, a Dr. Karen Hacker, the director of the CDC's National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion, tells Dr. Wolf that there's concern within the CDC about publishing this review without another review by, quote, NIH leadership. That's the National Institutes of Health. Hacker from the CDC says that there might be potential for a, quote, interagency review by the Department of Health and Human Services. So you start to see this dialogue about, like, well, hold on, we think we need to get some other people involved and continue reviewing this. Dr. Wolf from the NTP comes back with, we believe the current findings, as stated in the monograph, reflect the scope of our evaluation and the available scientific literature, and no revision is needed. So just kind of defending their work and saying we're not going to stop this. But while this is going on, other emails that they released show that within the CDC's Division of Oral Health, they were already discussing, like, hey, this thing needs to not come out. In a May 12, 2022 email, Hannon, the officer or bureaucrat from the CDC, is speaking to another person and says, the May 18th release date for the monograph is almost certainly not going to happen. OASH and NIHOD are pretty clearly going to get more involved. And the OASH is a reference to the Office of Assistant Secretary of Health, who we just discussed, Rachel Levine. And then the NIHOD is the National Institutes of Health Office of the Director, which is the highest office within the NIH. So you have the highest office within the Department of Health and Human Services and the highest office within the National Institute of Health, who Rachel Levine and the other one is a man named Lawrence A. Tabak, according to these emails, saying they were going to get involved. And then we have further information that makes that clear here on June 3rd. This is the final email. These communications point to direct intervention from the head of the NIH and Assistant Secretary for Health. And that was that first email I read earlier from the very beginning that says, the latest we heard yesterday is that ASH, Assistant Secretary for Health Levine, has put the report on hold until further notice. So I also got a quote here from one of the organizers with the Fluoride Action Network, a man named Jay Sanders, education and outreach director with Fluoride Action Network. He said these emails, quote, reveal a concerted effort at the highest level of the U.S. public health bureaucracy to squash a key report on fluoride neurotoxicities. Sanders also stated that the emails, quote, show the lengths these agencies are willing to go to protect their pet project, fluoridation, from any scientific scrutiny. So, yeah, the judge is, I'm guessing, reviewing all of this information, and then the next hearing will be Thursday, January 12th. But pretty crazy. I mean, maybe I'm silly for even being surprised by all this, but I mean, I think it's just so blatant, right? Like, at the highest levels, people still call fluoride a conspiracy, even though there's cases like this going on with experts presenting evidence, and now emails showing interference and intervening from the highest levels of the health part of the government.
I don't know. I think, is it interference or is that their role? I mean, come on, think about it. Fluoride, don't we have it on here on the local level because of local legislation? So why are they that concerned about it being revealed in this court case from a federal level? It's not like a federal mandate puts us on it, does it? I mean, it has its little bit of recommendation, but people voted for it. And then you got to think about, like, people on the local level legislated it in all these different places, right? So, like, in Houston, we have our $4 million contract back in the day when we checked into this. And in Dallas, they have theirs. How many different sources is this hydrofluorosilic acid coming from? Why do people on the federal level have an interest in this? I think it's kind of a little bit confusing there on that. I think Derek died. Derek, don't die. But yeah. So I don't know how much of that you heard, but
I heard something where you're talking about, like, you know, that it's on the local level, and, you know, I think that what they're mainly afraid of, though, this would just be my,
I want to understand their interest in stopping this.
I was going to say, I think it's honestly probably a legal thing, because if the judge does rule that fluoride is toxic and violates the EPA's Toxic Substance Abuse Act, that could open up the ADA, who's been recommending fluoride for 70 years, the CDC, who said that it's safe and healthy, the Health and Human Services, all the different agencies that have recommended fluoride, water fluoridation, or, you know, even taking it for the dentist or whatever, which studies are proving is not accurate. I believe that they would probably open them up to class action lawsuits if people can say, like, you know, hey, this study is showing loss of IQ points and thyroid problems and hip problems and stuff. They're probably, I'm sure a lawyer out there could find some people that would fit the bill, and I'm sure it could be difficult, but my guess is there is some of that motivation. But also the other thing, and we learned this in Houston, that, like you said, it's on the local level, so they make recommendations, but cities like Houston still go out and spend $4 million to contract, and they contract with Mosaic Co., which is a huge aluminum mining company based in Florida that has contracts with companies all over the country. So I'm guessing they are potentially a part of this equation too.
Yeah, I would imagine so. And that's kind of where I was going. Like, that's one of the questions I asked was, you know, where do the various municipalities get their hydrofluoroxylic acid from? Mosaic and probably a handful of others. So there's that aspect. So, you know, hunting for who benefits.
Exactly.
But I'm glad this court case is going on, and I expect it to take time. I expect it to take a long time, but I do think it's good because it puts it in the news. It puts, you know, people's stands on this in the news, and, you know, you can judge them based on that.
Yeah. Well, I hope it gets more coverage, guys. If you want to see that article I just covered, it's at thelastamericanvagabond.com. Thank you for that. Now, I just got a quick one before we move on to we got some IRS and some tax stuff going on that we'll wrap up with today. This one is, as I mentioned earlier, just another latest in many different court decisions going on related to mandates that took place in the last 2 years. This is coming from Courthouse News Service. It's just a really brief explanation, and then there's a link to the actual court documents if you want to see them. They titled it "No Vax, No Seat in the Orchestra." A federal court in Florida, federal court, and in Florida, where people love to their freedom, found in favor of the Naples Philharmonic on a lawsuit against the orchestra by former musicians who were fired for refusing to take the COVID vaccine. Accommodating them would have placed an undue hardship on the symphony's business operations, ruled the judge. And so I thought that alone, I mean, that's pretty much I looked at the documents earlier. I mean, it pretty much says that there might be some interesting stuff in here if somebody wants to read and to see the judge's actual reasoning and stuff like that. But that's essentially what he said, is, which is odd to me. He's saying that, yeah, if they try to accommodate these unvaccinated people or bring them back, that it would basically, it could bankrupt them or it could cause them, you know, financial stress. And so because of that, then these people are not allowed to come back. And I guess they're not going to be awarded any financial compensation or anything of that sort.
Yeah, I could understand letting them go during it, or as a judge, you know, siding with their right to let them go during the height of the pandemic, you know, because you're still trying to get people to go sit at an orchestra, socially distanced and all this stuff. And then you've got a person there that won't either mask up or be vaccinated. I wouldn't do either, you know, but nonetheless, I think that I could still understand, you know, having to get a different flute player to stay in business during that horrible time, you know, with the decisions being beyond your average individual. But yeah, I don't understand why you couldn't hire them back at this point with all that's coming out.
I think that's a charitable interpretation. I definitely think also that, you know, there's people who, you know, whether they feel entitled to, you know, get their jobs back or not. I personally wouldn't want to go back to somebody who is trying to get rid of me. But just so people know the circumstances, here's one section that clarifies what their ultimatum was. So it says, in October 2021, Artist Naples, which I guess is the company, placed the plaintiffs on leave with partial pay for the 2021-2022 concert season. It then offered the plaintiffs three options. One, take the COVID vaccine. Two, take another year of leave of absence, this time unpaid. So I guess they'd taken a previous one during the height of, or the beginning of the COVID stuff. So take a year of absence unpaid and return to work in 2023, 2024, if they get the shot. So either way, it's like, get the shot. Or three, resign from Artist Naples effective June 30th, 2022 and receive severance pay for 1 year thereafter, so long as they signed a full release of liability. And if they didn't choose any of this, which is basically take the shot now, take the shot later, or take some money and leave, then they would be terminated as of June 30th, 2022.
Or take another year for the lay of the land to change with no money.
Yeah. And so then it says plaintiffs did not choose any of the three options presented by them and instead submitted additional exemption requests in April 2022 using the forms prescribed by this Florida statute. And it goes on, this statute was enacted in November 2021, forbidding employers from imposing COVID vaccine mandates on its employees without providing individual exemptions based on, among other things, sincerely held religious beliefs. So they were trying to use the law because, you know, Ron DeSantis, whatever you think about him, he was passing things, or the governor and the local level, they were passing things to try to protect people from mandates, because even in Florida, there were places trying to do it, as you see here. And so they're trying to use the statute that was on the books and say, hey, look, we're allowed exemptions. Plaintiffs also emailed the people in April 22 to express their Artist Naples was violating the Florida statute by denying their religious exemptions. And yeah, so it goes on. But again, it found in favor of the Philharmonic, the organization, and not these individuals and their decision not to be shot in order to continue having their job or their seat in the orchestra.
Yeah,
and there'll be more of those kind of decisions. Some of them seem to fall on the side of the people, so to speak. Others are things like that, and I think that's one thing that I've tried to say, that, you know, if you sometimes, yeah, the courts rule in yours are, whatever you want to say, favor, and that could be a positive thing. But the idea of just not doing anything, for me at least, and just waiting for the courts to fix things is not a good idea. And we got a comment here from Michelle saying the Arch in St. Louis is now requiring masks. And this is one thing, while we're talking COVID stuff, we should mention that several countries now, including the U.S., have started to restrict travel from China again over this alleged new variant. New Jersey schools have started to reinstate mask mandates. Parts of California, other places in the U.S. are starting to bring them back. I don't know what's in store. All I know is a couple months ago, Bill Gates and the World Economic Forum and some other people held another exercise where Bill Gates was the keynote speaker, where they imagined that there could be another pandemic, and this time it could affect kids very badly. And it's just an exercise at the moment, simulation. But it reminds me a lot that there was an exercise called Event 201 in October 2019. And then a couple months later, we started hearing about this thing called COVID-19. So I don't know what's going on. But yeah, the masks are coming back. mandates are still there in some places, even if they're not. Some people aren't being given their job compensated. Yeah, it could be the version 2.0. But let's go ahead and get these last two stories, Micah, before we wrap up. I know you got some stuff to say about the taxes and the IRS. What are they doing now?
Well, let's get the IRS one at first, at least. I thought it was an interesting take, this one out of here. It's saying that, and it reminds us of something, the Border Patrol. Yeah, there's a great song by El Jumbotron, right? The Border Patrol, under orders to double in size, went on a massive hiring spree about 15 years ago, relaxing standards and cutting training to bring 8,000 more agents on board. And I think you might remember something like that going on with TSA, Derek. The agency quickly realized it had a problem. Agent-involved shootings rose. And drug cartels tried to plant operatives among the new hires. Congress had to step in and pass anti-corruption law, you know, because, you know, laws on laws, right, to try to patch up the problems. Fast forward, and now it's the IRS that's preparing to staff up. The agency is flush with cash from Capitol Hill. Lawmakers said they want a backlog of cases cleared and more revenue secured from the taxpayers. Experts say the IRS could repeat the mistakes of the Border Patrol at shootings as it scrounges for qualified recruits and cuts corners to bring them on board quickly. Because the job market is so tight, they're going to be getting bottom of the barrel folks. Not to be mean about it, but it's true, said Chris Edwards, who's a scholar at the Cato Institute, who tracks government bureaucracies. The IRS is going to have a real problem hiring quality people. So that's what's going on. There's a lot of concern about that. We should keep our eyes out for, you know, rogue IRS agents. I'm sure that's the term, right?
Well, and it makes me just think of the overall discussion that's been going on the last couple months about the 87,000 new IRS agents. And just in general, clearly it's expanding. It's getting bigger. What that will mean for us in everyday average life, we'll see.
Yeah, they've got things planned. They've got things planned, to say the least. But yeah, and then I just thought this was an interesting note. In case we got there. Says comparing the federal government spending to that of drunken sailors is a slight against drunken sailors. Having been a drunken sailor, I can affirm that because I could not go in the hole like they can. In 2022 alone, Washington spent $1.4 trillion over federal revenue, and we talked about that, and in doing so, pushed the national debt to almost $31.5 trillion. It can sound like a real abstract number. I think they like it that way. That way you don't think about it. A recent analysis out of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School observed that the nation's fiscal policy is in permanent imbalance as current debts plus projected future spending outstrips future tax revenue. The study further noted, the fiscal imbalance must be zero for a fiscal policy to be sustainable without future changes. Therefore, in order to balance the books, the study found the federal government would either have to cut spending by 30% or raise taxes by 40%. Of course, based on the current course set by any authoritarian in office, their new spending bills are estimated to add another $4.8 trillion to the deficit by 2031. So I think that's interesting, you know, because we talk about how they don't have to sell you the idea, and they don't have to sell you anything to do with it because they don't even have to raise taxes. They just inflate the money, and then, you know, they're further in debt. And until they finally start collecting and trying to pay anything to it or else do a massive cut in spending, no one's going to care. And this is the result of it. You know, it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And nobody could run their house like this. It's amazing that they're able to. And I don't believe with all those IRS agents being hired that they're able to. I think, you know, they're just trying to shore it up everywhere they can.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that, like we've said before, that there's no expectation of them actually having a balanced budget. You know, it's constant debt and debt and debt, and it's just the average person maybe feels like it's so disconnected from their lives, or they're just trying to keep their own house in order, so they're just like, yeah, whatever, the government's doing something. And every few months now, or every year, it seems like, oh, the government's going to shut down. We got to pass this must-pass bill, and, you know, trillions of dollars going here, billions of dollars to Ukraine, and whatever, new bombs and all this kind of stuff, and Yeah.
Maybe it helps them to think it's okay to be in debt themselves. You ever think about that? Like, oh, look, government spends money all like drunk and sober. Yeah.
They're kind of setting the mood, setting the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Well, guys, that's it for tonight's show. I want to remind you, you can find everything we just covered at thehoustonfreethinkers.com. Give us till the morning. It'll be posted up, all the archives there. You can follow us on Spotify if you listen to music there, Spotify, Apple, et cetera, et cetera. Look for Live Free, Think Free. And yeah, we'll be back next week, hopefully with Johnny. And I want to mention, because I want to close with one more new song. I've been releasing new songs here on Live Free, Think Free, only here, nowhere else. So some of these songs that I've been playing aren't even available yet. But I now have my website up. For those of you who know that I'm about to release an album as 33, the website is 33ishere.com. You can see this landing page. The album Transmutation is going to debut Monday morning, Monday like 12:01 a.m. You'll be available. You can hear it everywhere. The countdown begins 3 days and 4 hours. So I've got an email list if you want to sign up for those who want to follow, hear more about that. I appreciate that. But I'm going to close with a new song. This one, it's a... early in the journey of this album called Transmutation, about growth, change, and struggle. It's called Fighting Demons, and I think you'll enjoy it. It is not necessarily kid-friendly, so if they're around, earmuffs might be necessary. And, yeah, anything else, Micah, before we end with this song?
No, it's pretty exciting. I'm looking forward to the rest of the album. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in, commenting, and sharing, and being there. Really some thought-provoking stuff comes up. And y'all make this all worthwhile to both of us.
Absolutely. We'll see you next week. Here's Fighting Demons from 33. Peace.
From the moment I wake up, I'm fighting demons. I know they're there even if I can't see them. Let me tell you a story about the time they beat me. Broke me down, rearranged, left in deep deep. Ran to some old homies from school, parties on. Only took 2 weeks before my sanity's gone. Passing plates of coke, acid, and crystal meth. I didn't even like this shit, man, it felt like death. Within a week, I was so weak, I could barely stand. Lost my job and my girl, got no helping hand. Man, I'm just trying to find myself. Somehow I keep coming up with someone else. I just need a pause. Can we stop the world? Why do I do this? I can't escape myself. I keep falling, I'm only hurting myself. Why did you do this? And I can't find myself. You keep running, man, I'm only hurting myself. Well, it wasn't all bad, sometimes there were laughs. Maybe that was the drugs and the laughing gas. All I know is I couldn't escape the nightmare. Started selling dope, telling myself, don't be scared. Why can't I stop doing drugs when they clearly hold me back from the future I want so dearly? Everything's spinning out of control, get the fuck away. I really don't have time to do this today. Can you please just let me breathe? Things are going too fast, I can barely see. I know I'm paranoid and I'm losing weight, but I swear I'm not using dope, just wait. I promise I'm more. Just give me a chance. Why do I do this? I can't escape myself. And I keep falling, I'm only hurting myself. Why did you do this? And I can't find myself. You keep running, man, I'm only hurting myself. I wish there was a happy ending to this journey. Maybe I was destined for bars or a gurney. Maybe it was inevitable, maybe it's my fate. I'm not a vegetable, just paralyzed with self-hate. It's family tradition, I joined my dad in prison. But I found myself, a new me arisen. I can't say it was easy, but it was worth the time. Taking steps to reclaim what's mine. I'm healing wounds for all the broken sons. I'm standing over the graves of my loved ones. Friends gone too soon, even my own father. Knowing that could be me if I didn't bother to heal myself and my darkest pains. Why do I do this? I can't escape myself. And I keep falling, I'm only hurting myself. Why did you do this? And I can't find myself.